Hi, thanks for checking out Press Play and our podcast. And when you're done with this one, I have another one that you're going to love. I just know it. It's a podcast about design and architecture, cars, gadgets, all sorts of things that make up our built and beautiful world. It's hosted by someone who is an insider who knows everything about design and architecture, Frances Anderton, and the podcast is called DNA. It's on KCRW's iTunes page, so check it out.
Practice if you were the only people here.
Aren't we?
They are here. He's here. I'm here. And I'm becoming very, very bored.
My.
If you make history here by punching a lady.
I won't have it.
Now look, you know perfectly well. You know perfectly well that I'm the gentlest of the four people here.
I just hope it lasts through the next whatever we have left.
The Dick Cavett Show was usually more cerebral than that day in 1971 when writer Janet Flanner appeared with Gore Vidal and his nemesis Norman Mailer. We'll talk with Dick Cavett, the master of the erudite conversation, later in today's show. But first, Thanksgiving is a rare day on LA's Skid Row when you can find celebrities and city officials serving up meals to the homeless. The Midnight Mission is especially popular with volunteers, and it's preparing for a big crowd tomorrow. I recently sat down with one person who has worked there day in and day out longer than anyone else.
Peter, I can't talk right now. Call me back in about 25 minutes.
Clancy Immislin has been managing director of the Midnight Mission for 40 years. And before that, he was a client there, struggling with addiction, looking for a meal. We talked about his recovery and specifically 12-step work, which he made part of the Midnight Mission's program. But he started by taking me back to his first day on Skid Row.
In 1954, I was here one morning. I was on the run kind of from Dallas. I had no clothes, no ID, no nothing. A week before, I'd been a very big executive in Dallas. And here I was standing on the street corner, my teeth kicked out, no place to go. And the guy said, "You want to sell a pint of blood?" And I said, "Do I ever?" And we walked 8 blocks up to a blood bank, and they said I didn't have enough iron in my blood to sell a pint of blood anymore. He said, "Down here about 4 blocks, there's something called the Midnight Mission. It's designed for bums like you. You go down there and get some breakfast." I said, "Okay." And I shuffled on down to the 4th and Los Angeles Street, and I said, "I need some breakfast." He said, "Well, we just got done serving." I said, "Well, God, I got to have something, just something bite to eat. You get up so sick." He said, "We have nothing to give you. Come back at noon, we'll give you a big lunch." I grabbed him by the lapels. I said, "Damn it, I got to have something to eat." And two guys stepped over, each of them undid one hand and threw me out the door and said, "Don't come back, you son of a bitch." I had no idea that'd be my sobriety date. And that was October 31st, 1958.
And how old were you?
I was 31. So just the other day, I celebrated 56 years of sobriety. I drank a great deal, and I fought to stop drinking for years. It cost me my family, it cost me my career, everything I had. And the last day that I left, got thrown out of the Midnight Mission, I would have bet my life there was no answer to my problem. But it got so bad that I allowed a recovery program to manifest its recovery steps over my noggin. And much to my surprise, it worked. First thing you do, you acknowledge the fact you have a problem, which is hard to do sometimes. Because if I acknowledge I have a problem, I can't do it anymore, and I want to do it. And then you accept the fact there's some power somewhere greater than you that's going to help you. Usually you have a person who is you're close to, they call them a sponsor, who becomes, in effect, your almost father in a way, or mother. In my case, I decided my sponsor was the power that was going to help me, finally. Because I couldn't accept God because I'd been raised in a very, very strong church. And one night in Texas, I was in jail, and they had to come and tell me my little son had just died. And I felt so angry at God that I cursed God and screw you, God. And over the period of time, you take various actions of unburdening. You have to go around and make a lot of amends to people who you've hurt along the way. But it's a great rewarding thing. Because the purpose of all these steps, all the purpose of all the meetings and sponsorship and everything, is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. to change me in a position where it's a friendly world and I'm adequate.
Did you ever waver?
No matter how hard you work any program, you never rise above human being. And human beings are all flawed to one degree or another.
There are all sorts of different philosophies when it comes to treating alcohol and drug addiction. There are experimental drugs being used. There's the idea that you shouldn't go for total abstinence. There are other ways of handling it.
You shouldn't go for total abstinence on the people who can't get off it. Probably maybe one in three it'll work for, but you got to do it. That two in three will not do the difficult things that bring it about.
But are there other ways of becoming sober?
Well, the radio there is. They have all these commercials of miracle cures in Malibu and so on. But I've never seen any recoveries. One of the things people think about Skid Row is, why don't they just get these people, give them jobs and places to live, and they'll be all right. But the problem here is something entirely different. Skid Row is not conducive to ordinary recoveries. I would say of all the people I have known over the years, the one factor that's present in everyone on Skid Row, they have, to one degree or another, lost the ability to deal with conflict within themselves or conflict from outside. And usually the slightest trace of conflict is back to drinking or drugs or running away. And that is when I first came down here to run the place, I was very upset. I'd get a guy a job and a nice little apartment, and next thing he'd be on the street again. Why? It took me a long time to realize they can't stand the normal conflict that you and we all take every day, every minute practically. You know. So what we try to do here, we have about 275 men living in right now, and we're teaching them how to make a resume, how to run a computer, how to live in the world. And then, incidentally, as they go along without knowing it, they're learning how to deal with conflict. I'd wait a second. Hello.
Throughout our conversation, Clancy was interrupted by phone calls from all over the world, from the many people he now sponsors.
That's in Rockford, Illinois, which is also freezing. But here's something over there that I'll show you funny. My drinking was bad to the point where I got expelled from the University of Wisconsin in 1950 for drinking, just before graduation. In 1980, because of my work here at the Mission, they named me the Distinguished Alumnus of the Year. Then I started writing them notes saying, isn't that kind of crappy to have the Alumnus of the Year? Who's not even an alumnus? So in 1987, they finally sent me my diploma. So there's my diploma, graduating in 87, Alumnus of the Year 1980. Kind of a cute situation.
And here I see you have a certificate for serving in World War II.
Yeah, I was one of the surviving members of World War II. We had a Veterans Day the other day, and Tuesday here, and I gave a little talk on behalf of the veterans of World War II. Although around here they think I'm a veteran of the Civil War, but I'm not. Pretty old. Hello.
That's Call Clancy Immisland. I spoke to him recently in his office at the Midnight Mission.
Well, call me back, kid, when you get a chance. We're on Pacific time now, remember, the United States. We're not on English time, so you got to figure out the hour difference. Okay.
Now let's look at the bigger picture when it comes to addiction. Few people are actual alcoholics. The Centers for Disease Control says just 10% of heavy drinkers meet the criteria for alcoholism. That study is one of many recent publications diving into the science of addiction. While all this information is shedding new light on how addiction works, it also highlights the fact that a lot of it is still a mystery. Timothy Fung is an associate professor of psychiatry at UCLA, and he specializes in research and treatment of addiction. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with this CDC study about alcoholism. It came out recently, and it says that one in three adults drinks too much. And I think they define that by if you're a woman, drinking 8 or more drinks a week, and 15 if you're a man. But of those, the vast majority aren't alcoholics. So what does that mean?
Well, very simply, let me back up even more. We know that about 60% of Americans drink on a regular basis. This particular new study, what's interesting is that the heavy drinking is the first step to screening for alcoholism. So just because you drink a lot of alcohol doesn't mean you're an alcoholic.
How do you define alcoholism?
So by very simply, alcoholism is a chronic relapsing condition where your drinking patterns have caused problems to your life and you continue to drink. It's as simple as that. Even more simply, I like to say to patients, does your drinking improve the quality of your life or does it hurt the quality of your life? If it hurts the quality of your life, more than likely you have a problem with alcohol.
But a lot of people can be what's called functional alcoholics, meaning they can go about their lives just fine, but they do need to drink maybe every day.
Right. And so functional alcoholism isn't a, quote, scientific term. It's an urban myth. Basically, if you drink and you have a little bit of problem and you can get by with it, it's still alcoholism. We now think of alcoholism as mild, moderate, or severe spectrum. So I think of that term as functional alcoholism. It's really someone with mild alcohol use disorders. It means they're already having some problems in their life. They're using alcohol to cover it up or make it better. Addiction, alcoholism, these things fluctuate. They come and go. But when they show up and the consequences are very, very obvious, it's very clear. For the most part, though, many patients are in that gray area where they're not quite sure.
How do you define binge drinking?
Heavy drinking or / binge drinking is defined as having more than 5 standard drinks in one occasion for a man or more than 4 standard drinks for a woman in a single occasion.
So would that count for, you know, on Thanksgiving when you're, you know, eating for a couple hours or so and you've had 4 glasses of wine over the course of maybe 4 or 5 hours?
It certainly can. And again, it depends on how you define a standard drink. You know, a standard drink is usually a 12-ounce beer, a 5-ounce glass of wine, a 1.5-ounce hard shot. Some of our patients define a standard drink as something that comes in a box. I mean, clearly that's not an appropriate size. Now, the reason why we just call it heavy drinking is that through science, it tells us that if you go above 5 drinks per day on a man, that means there is an increased chance not only of alcohol addiction, but also of just bodily harm or alcohol intoxication, which could then lead to, of course, bad things. So it's really meant to be kind of a yellow flag rather than a red flag, whereas a yellow flag says this is a cautionary line, and if you go above that, let's look at it more closely, rather than a red flag, meaning that if you go beyond it, you absolutely are in no man's land and that this is absolutely a horrible thing.
Okay, so when you think of it that way, when you think of like once a year, someone drinks excessively, how many people do that?
Numbers I've seen for a single episode of heavy drinking, it depends on the population you're looking at. If you're looking at a college population, that can be as high as 35-40%. If you're looking at a geriatric population, that number is around 5-6%. If you're looking at the U.S. general population, that number can be as high as 12-15%. So for just a single episode of heavy drinking.
So a lot of people do that.
A lot of Americans do it. A lot of people do that. And again, that's where people get, you know, to be honest, they get a little freaked out when they see that, oh my gosh, I'm going beyond the recommended amount of drinking that the U.S. government tells me I must be an alcoholic. That's absolutely not the case.
When it comes to the nature of the brain, are addicts' brains different? Alcoholics' brains different?
You know, it's funny. We get that question a lot. I mean, all our brains are different. We know certainly that when it comes to addiction, that biologically, yes, their brains are born differently. They have biological risk factors, genetic differences in structure and function of their brain. Their brain responds differently to alcohol at a much younger age than non-alcoholics. So very much we know that there are significant biological and physical contributions about why people develop alcohol use disorders.
Can you tell by a child's behavior, for instance, if that person might be more prone to becoming an alcoholic or an addict later in life?
You know, this is one of the hot areas of addiction research, is that what are the precursors, what are the signs, what are the prodromal things we can spot early on? And some people have thought, well, high impulsivities, but as it stands right now, we don't have biological tests. We don't have, you know, brain scans that can pick up, say, a 6 or 7 year old and say, this person is very much at risk.
And when it comes to treatment, what do you think of abstinence-only programs like AA?
Well, AA is a part of treatment. It's not treatment in of itself, because it's not run by a treatment provider, but it's a critical part of treatment. Nowadays, when I think about what's hot in the field of addiction treatment and recovery, we have a lot of different scientifically based ways to get people recovered. Sobriety and abstinence is just one part of recovery. So when patients come into our office, what we're saying to them is, yes, of course I want you to stop drinking or reduce your drinking, but I'm much more interested in you improving the quality of your life, you having a more meaningful life experience full of friendships and community and purpose and self-care and well-being. Abstinence oftentimes goes along with that, but for some patients, harm reduction or reduction in the amount of drugs that they're or alcohol they're using will take that as an improvement. And that's been a little bit of a sea change compared to the way things were 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but people who work the program, who are in it, say, look, it's been around for, 80 years or so, because it works, because mm-hmm. this is, they'll say, the only thing that works long-term.
Right. Well, the way I think about that, you know, aspirin's been around for a long time, so is lithium and a lot of these other wonderful medications we have, but we also have a lot of new technologies that work as well. The marvelous thing about recovery, and I like using that word, is that there's a lot of different ways to get to the same place. 12-step is one way, and maybe it works terrific for one patient, but for another patient, it may not work for them, and they have to go with a more practical-based psychotherapy model. 12-step, abstinence-based, these are all just one part of the toolbox we have to get people better. The biggest problem I see in our field is that we just don't have enough treatment providers specializing in addiction. We have a tremendous amount of demand for services, but we just don't have big enough of a workforce in getting people specialized and scientifically based treatments at work.
Timothy Fong is an associate professor of psychiatry at UCLA. He specializes in research and treatment of addiction. Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
We want to hear from you. Have you struggled with addiction? What has helped you manage your addiction? Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or share your story with us on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, President Obama's new clean air rules and what they might mean for the air we breathe here in Los Angeles, which has some of the dirtiest air in the country. That story is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Environmental Protection Agency proposed new smog rules today. The stricter standards target smog-producing factories and power plants by limiting how much ozone they can pump into the air. Ozone causes smog. Smog, in turn, causes all kinds of problems like asthma, heart disease, even premature death. And it just so happens that California is the capital of smog in America. Chip Jacobs is the author of Smogtown, The Lung-Burning History of Pollution in Los Angeles, and his new book is called The People's Republic of Chemicals. It's out this week. Hi, Chip.
Hello.
Oh, there you are. We
Sorry
lost
about
you
that.
In a blanket of smog. Maybe.
It was. I know. It gets into the transmission wire.
Okay. So how is it that we here in L.A. are still the capital of smog? I mean, I lived here in the 1970s, and we often couldn't play outdoors. There was so much smog in the air, and sometimes you couldn't really see your hand in front of your face, I guess. So it's gotten a lot cleaner here in L.A. and still we're the capital of smog?
We are still the capital. Things have gotten dramatically better. The problem is we started at such a low point we had nowhere to go but up. If you look at the number of days where our ozone was unhealthy, if you go back to 1996 time, it was about 190 days. A few years ago, it was only 122 days out of the year when our ozone was considered unhealthful. So we are making big progress. However, we have three counties in the area that are among the worst in the United States for ozone pollution. As particulate matter pollution is a big issue too, but we're still leading this, leading the way for having filthy air despite gigantic improvements in effort.
What are those three counties?
They are Los Angeles, Riverside, and San Bernardino. All these places get failing grades, according to the American Lung Association, when you look at ozone pollution, which, as you correctly said, is really the primary smog culprit. You asked, why is it still so bad, you couldn't see your hand, and people were coughing, and smog alerts. The problem is, for every gain we make with technology and trying to live with more sustainability, we're adding more people. There's a heck of a lot more cars, millions of more cars on the roads in the last 20 years. So, it's a question of mathematics. You can only make so much gain when you have more exhaust pipes spewing and you have more people here and, we're not moving the mountains away.
And even though California has mandated that 12% of vehicles this year must be zero emissions sold in California, still, because there are just more cars in general, it's just...
Right.
Yeah.
And, hybrids are great, but they're still a very fractional part of the overall car usage. I think it's something like 3% of cars on the road today are hybrids. And that is not exactly a vision of the future. We are still very tied to fossil fuel. Cars have gotten a lot more gas efficient, but still, we just have too many people and too much hydrocarbon and combustion in too small an area.
So how would these new EPA rules change that?
These new rules would be pretty dramatic, and it would kick a lot of smaller communities that are currently in compliance out of compliance. It's going to mean going back to the car makers and saying, you know what, you guys have made incredible improvements. You're going to have to get your engineers working overtime to lower down what's coming out of those tailpipes further. You're going to have to seek new over-the-horizon types of solutions. Power plants, smokestacks, industry is also going to have to do a lot of going back, and they're going to complain, and there's going to be hue and cry, because in many ways, we've squeezed them as tightly as we can. And, we're sort of going after incremental gains, because we don't know what else to do. We can't exactly tell, 5 million people to leave California.
Right. So help me understand where the onus falls, because if we don't have a lot of industry, heavy industry here in California, and these rules do attack these factories, who's going to be responsible for lowering the ozone layer in levels in the air?
It's a great question. I don't know where they're going to get the gains. Apparently, California is not going to have to comply with this lower limit until 2037. All the very dirty urban areas, the EPA understands we've pushed technology to its limit, and we're going to have to, buy a generation of time. So 2037 is off on the ways. I think we're looking at very slow gains and continuing to see people get sick. Continuing to see asthma attacks, and we have a really other scary problem, which is what's coming over the horizon from China. People might not be able to associate that, because ozone, after all, is invisible. But on some days, a third or a quarter of our ozone pollution in LA is from the People's Republic of China. In Sacramento Valley, sometimes it's three quarters of the ozone. While we are trying in the United States to, and especially California, to live sort of more horizontal, get away from urban sprawl, the Chinese are living much more American. And some people say there could be 400 million Chinese with cars by 2030. That is going to greatly complicate our ability to, bring ozone down to a very minor health problem.
So is it possible at all that the United States could extract some kind of agreement from China to lower their ozone to...
Yeah, it gets very tricky. What right do we have to tell another country that is actually doing a lot right, but it's growing so furiously, it's killing the progress. What right do we have to say, you have to go tinker with your engines because our people are suffering over here? To answer your question, I don't know where we're going to get all the changes from because in Los Angeles, we already have half our manufacturing numbers through deindustrialization. We're half our numbers. There used to be about 800,000 blue-collar manufacturing jobs here. Now there's about 400,000. So that means there's a lot of smokestacks, a lot of industry, a lot of boilers that have now been shipped overseas. And so I think our hands are tied a bit. What seems obvious is that you can't expect one region to clean up if the neighboring country is polluting like mad.
And meanwhile, it hasn't rained in a while, and so that hasn't helped things.
No, it has not helped things. And, if we get a lot of forest fires, drought produces a lot of very dry brush, obviously that's just incredible fuel. We can add smoke and dust and other elements to it. So in a way, we're a bit of a sitting duck. Global warming seems to be upon us earlier than we thought, and the drought does make it more difficult. Actually, in China, one of the favorite things to do, especially when they have a big event, is try to shoot rockets into the sky to induce rain. And people laugh and scoff. I don't think it's that inconceivable. We may have to look at that ourselves if we go through more and more years of drought. I think some desperation may creep in.
Mm. Chip Jacobs, LA-based journalist and smog historian. His new book is called The People's Republic of Chemicals. Chip, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, Dick Cavett is here, the master of the genteel interview. Talks about the dust-up he had with Norman Mailer on live TV, and he talks about being on Nixon's enemies list. That's after a news update with Steve Chiotakis.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Dick Cavett was always an unusual TV talk show host. He's a Yale-educated literary buff known for his interviews that flow more like conversations between old friends. During the heyday of The Dick Cavett Show in the 1960s and 70s, Cavett conversed with movie stars, rock stars, authors, heads of state. His guests were often candid. Heated arguments and personal revelations were typical for the show, like this one between Norman Mailer and Gore Vidal.
I would apologize if it hurts your feelings. Of course I would.
No, it hurts my sense of intellectual pollution.
Well, I must say,
as an expert,
you should know about that.
I would like to... Yes, well, I've had to smell your works from time to time, and that has helped me to become an expert on intellectual pollution, yes.
Yeah, well...
Now, Dick Cavett has a new book out. It's called Brief Encounters, and it's a collection of short essays chronicling his experiences in showbiz, some outside it, and he joins me now. Welcome.
I hope I am, because I'm not maybe your tallest fan. Well, you can finish that yourself.
Well, that clip, that was from 1971.
Yes, and I know you protected the listeners from the most violent moments.
Well, I don't think I will, because I do want to play the rest of that clip, because it involves you.
Oh, okay,
you.
Go.
At one point, you decide to take sides, and you take Gore Vidal's side, and you kind of get into it with Norman Mailer. And let me just play that clip of tape.
I guarantee you I wouldn't hit any of the people here, because they are smaller.
In what ways?
Intellectually. Well. Intellectually smaller.
Perhaps you'd like two more chairs to contain your giant intellect.
Why don't you look at your question sheet and ask a question? Hey, can I talk to the audience for
a moment? Why don't you fold it five ways and put it where the moon don't shine?
That was all ad-libbed, I assume.
I don't know where that key moment came from, unless it's what I might call Nebraska tribal memory or something. I don't remember ever knowing that. And as you know, misquotation is rampant. And people will often say, I loved when you told him to stick it. No. Stick it would be vulgar.
Were you friends with Mailer off stage?
Yeah, we were before that, and certainly again after. That was a tempestuous show. It's like a great 90-minute play. The tension grows. The danger gets bigger and more ominous. And I did not know till afterwards that Gore told me that Norman had head-butted him in the green room beforehand.
Oh, my gosh.
And Norman, whom humor was largely left out of, was really not able to cope with Gore's dazzling wit. And there was one sentence in that show that night, and I knew that I would remember it a week later. Norman said, Gore, could you mind just talking to me? You know, trying to get yucks from the audience, but just talk to me. I'd be happy to talk only to you, Norman, but as it happens, we find ourselves not in the friendly neighborhood bar, but by election in front of a studio audience, and it would be dishonest of us to pretend otherwise. Applause.
And that was on network television.
Mm-hmm.
A battle of supreme wits.
You can imagine how excited ABC was, who was always urging me to get big stars, which I did, and saying, oh, good God, Kavitz got three authors on tonight. Authors being a filthy word at a network. It means it's synonymous with boredom in their little world. But anyway, you can't deal with those people.
Well, you had John Lennon on and Yoko Ono.
Yes.
Not just once. They were on twice.
Yeah, that was great. No one could believe they were coming on once, including me. And then they did come back.
She didn't split the Beatles because how could one girl split the Beatles or one woman? You know? The Beatles were drifting apart on their own, you know.
Can you remember when you realized that it was inevitable that you would split up?
No. It's like saying, you know, did you remember falling in love? Not quite. Yeah. No. Just sort of happened.
Well, how did you get them? They were notoriously press shy. How did you get them to be on your show?
You know, I don't know. Somebody on my staff said, let's try for them. And I thought, lots of luck. And they did. And but they said, they haven't agreed to come on. They've agreed to meet you. And I went to the St. Regis one day. And a rainy day, I got there wet. And Yoko had to dry me off. And they were in their suite. And they were on the bed. Not what some are thinking, but working. He had a lot of folders out. John always had a lot of projects. And Yoko did. It went well. And I wanted to make John laugh. He was so accessible, so congenial, so easy to talk to. We were getting along well, and then I said, he said, you know, you've got the only halfway intelligent talk show on television. And I said, why would you want to be on a halfway intelligent show? And we both had a hearty laugh over that.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with legendary talk show host Dick Cavett. His new memoir is called Brief Encounters. In it, he writes about one person who was not a fan, President Richard Nixon. I asked him about that. What did you do to earn his enmity?
Just about everything, apparently. I learned later of astonishing statistics. The fact that I'm on 26 Nixon tapes is remarkable to me and flattering in a way.
A badge of honor, maybe?
I've only heard a couple of them. Yeah, Paul Newman said he would trade his Oscars for being on the Nixon's enemies list. Anyway, what did I do to the poor guy?
Right.
A number of things. They were very unhappy with people who were on the show, and I learned later that they had a scorekeeper on talk shows, especially mine. Then, of course, I made the awful White House blunder of testifying that John Lennon that he shouldn't be deported.
One of the people you had on, he didn't like at all, and that was John Kerry, who is Secretary of State now. Then he was an unknown 27-year-old Vietnam veteran, and he was advocating for ending the war. And let's just play a short clip of tape. This is from 1974.
Is the United States of America determined to leave Vietnam? And if we are determined to leave Vietnam, which I believe the president has shown some indications of, because he has withdrawn troops, we don't deny that. What we say is the troops can be withdrawn faster. What we say is the killing can stop tomorrow.
So that's John Kerry, 27 years old, full head of dark hair. There was another man on stage there with you named John O'Neill, who was defending the war and the administration, and the two got into it. Tell us about that, because I believe that that segment also got you onto President Nixon's bad side.
Well, yeah, I was thoroughly on his bad side, so there wasn't much more of his side to be bad on. But John O'Neill was the opponent on that show. I don't like to book shows where you have Mr. Right and Mr. Left and Mr. This and Mr. That and Mr. Abortion and Miss No Abortion. But this case, this was the logical opposition. And John O'Neill seemed to be somebody who sort of volunteered to come on. And then we learned later that he had been secretly coached by the White House, in fact, probably invited to the White House, and coached to come on and do what he did.
Do you regret anything that you said on the air?
Oh, any number of things, yeah. Not one leaps to mind, which is known as the Freudian ability to fog bad memories. Mm. But it's not fun when you call a guest by the wrong name. I'm sorry I wasn't harder on a couple of people. And should I be apologizing for in my first week finding the first time a guest angered me? My first week, through all the nerves and all the fear, Timothy Leary, advocating tuning in, turning on, dropping out, as you may recall, not in that order, and hawking LSD. And I said, I really think you're full of crap. And a woman in Iowa wrote, she laughed so hard she dropped her iron on her left foot.
Oh, no.
The network left it in. If I'd said it to Spiro Agnew, who equally was, of course, they would have probably taken it out.
So given all the different people that were on your show, from, as I said earlier, politicians to heads of state to actors, they were just the biggest names in the culture of the day. And the way you held, you could talk to them for an hour. Yeah. It's hard not to look at what's happening now on television and really mourn the loss of that kind of conversation. Do you watch any TV talk shows?
Yeah, I know all the guys and gals, so it's a little difficult for me to talk about them. I've been a Jimmy Fallon fan since first laying eyes upon him, and I have an upcoming problem now because when before Stephen Colbert goes on his show, I'll have to wear out my TiVo watching them both. But what a thing it will be to be able to have access to Colbert's full personality, vast knowledge, and wondrousness.
So you think that he could maybe do something similar to what you did?
Oh, yeah, he would be likely to. But he's also, I understand, the way that Stewart and Colbert can get magic out of a 6 or 7 minute talk with somebody. It's much easier to do my 90-minute shows with Orson Welles and Lucy and all those people than it is to do 7 minutes with them. And yet they manage to be both funny and Colbert doing it at one remove in a personality that is not his own.
Yeah, it's quite a performance.
What a feat.
But I think also the audience expects things to happen much, much quicker these days. They don't have the patience to sit through an hour-long interview.
People keep saying to me, nobody does what you did. I was on something yesterday, and you just have to take my word for it. I was so good, they were sorry they only had me on for 7 or 8 minutes. but you get used to that when you're in the business of plugging your book, Brief Encounters. Oh, that was a plug. I'm sorry. And people say, but we used to love those long ones. 90 Minutes, which is closer, in fact, is an hour and 62 with all the bloody commercials, can be very satisfying because a guest who's uptight at first can relax and then get more relaxed. And then I loved it when at the end of one of those, one of them would say, I don't know how you got me so comfortable that I talked about what I talked about. I can't believe you got that out of me, you know, that kind of thing. That'll happen if you have long enough and time to dig it out.
Mm. Well, unfortunately, we have to end this interview.
Well, wait a minute. We're talking about not enough time.
I know. It's ironic.
It's one of the ironies of our business.
It is.
Do you have 20 seconds?
I do.
I had a guest come on one time and mention his book 14 times in fewer minutes.
Really? Which book was it? Do you remember?
And I said nothing. I don't know what it was. And at the end, I said, thanks for being here. By the way, did we get the name of your book in?
We didn't get the name of your book in that often. So let's get the name of the book in.
Oh, well, do we have time for me to say it over and over three times? Brief Encounters, Brief Encounters, Brief Encounters.
I think that's the name. Brief Encounters. Dick Cavett, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
One more time, Brief Encounters. Let's have a brief encounter.
We're going to have a brief encounter right now.
Yes.
We're going to be talking on To the Point about the situation in Ferguson and how it has affected the rest of the country and the way that blacks and whites look at it so differently. It's very interesting. And we're going to change the subject a bit and talk about cyber warfare, which is a very interesting subject. Turns out, of course, that it's going on all the time. We're at war with various countries, and the battlefield is something we're all on, and that's the Internet.
Okay, that's at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you very much. And we're going to talk about the Ferguson story and how it's playing out online next. Your Facebook and Twitter feeds say a lot about what you think. And we'll also talk about the app from Miranda July, the artist that allows strangers to deliver texts in person. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The stories coming out of Ferguson, Missouri, didn't just dominate headlines this week. They dominated our Facebook pages and our Twitter accounts, pushing cute kitty pictures to the margins to make room for images of angry protesters and burning cars. And it's no surprise. Anytime a controversial story like this blows up, the debate moves online, and we find ourselves arguing with friends, former acquaintances, and some guy we maybe met at a party once. But is social media creating a healthy national dialogue or creating more division? Our pal Alex Goldman joins me now. He co-hosts the podcast Reply All. It's a show about the internet. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
You've been looking at some of the ways the Ferguson story has been playing out online. And do you have anything positive to report, or are we mainly seeing each other flamed in flame wars?
Well, you know, there's an article on Quartz right now by a woman named Emma Pearson, who's a statistician, and she actually did sort of a data visualization of the conversations about Ferguson on Twitter. And if you look at the visualization, it's incredibly stark that there are these two giant clusters. One is red, one is blue, and there are a few membranes that sort of keep them connected, but otherwise they're just these wholly separate entities. And her analysis, her semantic analysis of tweets, is that conservative people tend to communicate with like-minded conservative people. Liberals tend to communicate with like-minded liberals. And the only time they interact is to just sort of spew bile at one another.
I guess that doesn't surprise me. Does it surprise you?
It doesn't, only because the makeup of a Twitter feed is very carefully curated. You're allowed to see whomever you want, block whomever you want. There's no social obligations on Twitter in the way that there are on Facebook. So you can just kind of follow whoever you want. And you tend to follow people whose political beliefs reinforce your own.
Yeah, I read a report from Pew last week that said that liberals are more likely to defriend someone if they post an offensive thing or something they didn't like on Facebook.
Well, you know, it's funny because Gene Demby from NPR has been, he just sort of casually asked people how their Facebook feeds were reacting to this. And I think a Facebook feed is different from a Twitter feed in that, yes, you can curate it and yes, you can mute people, but it's made up less of a carefully curated group of strangers than it is your friends and family. And a lot of times when you have closer relationships with people, you tend to get into ideological territory where you strongly disagree and you have to navigate it more carefully. So he was asking, you know, how are you dealing with this? And it was a lot of people just saying, like, I'm muting people, I'm not even logging in today, or just pointing out all the outrageous things that their relatives were saying.
Well, that's a perfect preamble to Thanksgiving, I guess. Let's move on to artist Miranda July. She's trying to bring back the human touch, I guess, to text messaging with mixed results. Tell us about her project.
So the first episode of our new podcast, Reply All, is about Miranda July's app. It's called Somebody. It's like sending a text message. You put something up there, you designate it for a specific person, but rather than it just delivering to them over the phone, someone else who also uses the Somebody app will find that message and walk to that person and physically deliver the message to them. So it could be anything from, do you want to go get dinner tonight, to I hate you and never want to talk to you again. And it's actually delivered by a person. And the person can also receive stage directions like cry while you're delivering it or yell while you're delivering it. So the idea is to take this sort of cold, very clinical kind of interaction that we have every day, hundreds of times a day sometimes, and bring it into the physical world in a way that is interesting, a little awkward, and a little human.
So in your podcast, you talk to a guy named Sam who is actually on the receiving end of one of these messages. And let's play a clip of tape of him describing the experience.
And so I walked in the bookstore, and there's this dude there. He's kind of... he's like blonde, short hair, kind of stocky, and he looks at me and he goes, "Sam?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "It's me, Ariel." And then he walks up to me and he puts his hand on my shoulder and he says, "I f-ing love you and I don't know how to tell you."
So he's actually speaking the words for this woman, Ariel,
right,
to Sam. What did Sam do?
Sam kind of didn't know what to do. And I think that's sort of a symptom of this new medium. It's like, how do you respond to, there's so many layers there. First, there's the technological layer, and then there's the layer of this added person who you've never met. How do you respond to that kind of thing? So Sam sent back a very cordial email that just said, that was really sweet how you sent me that Somebody message. Thanks. I'm glad we're still friends, even though we're not dating anymore.
It's kind of like a singing telegram. It's awkward. You don't really.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. It is. It's exactly like a singing telegram. But it's made more awkward by the fact that it seems like the people who are delivering them are invested in them, because the guy who delivered that message to Sam afterward said, "So, can you tell me what the context of this is? I mean, what's this all about?"
Sounds like a big art project for Miranda July, more than
anything else. I mean, it is, but I think that it gestures at all the sort of bizarre ways we communicate these days, you know?
So let's talk about another new app that you talked about on your podcast recently. It's a so-called Instagram for doctors.
Yeah, it's this app called Figure One that I didn't realize existed until fairly recently. Basically, it's Instagram, but instead of taking pictures of food or taking pictures of your friends or your trip to Spain or whatever, you're taking pictures of injuries in operating rooms or in hospitals and then sharing them online. And the idea is you can get help with diagnosis. But it's really, I think, much more for doctors to just gawk at one another's disgusting injuries that they see.
Well, what about the patients? Isn't that a violation of patient privacy?
The patient has to actually sign a waiver through the app before they can upload it. So it's totally legal in that respect. And the patient also is anonymized in that they don't show their faces or anything. So it's not like you see who they are. But we talked to a doctor who said that because she's so inoculated to seeing this stuff in the hospital all the time, is that she actually just uses it like we use Instagram. Just like, oh, that's interesting. That guy's foot fell off or whatever. It's pretty wild.
Did you see any really amazing pictures when you looked at it?
Yes. We saw some stuff that was pretty gruesome. There was an x-ray of what looks like someone who'd swallowed a USB key. The worst one was that there was a diabetic who didn't have feeling in his feet, and he came to the hospital because a rat had chewed off part of his foot.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. That's the exact reaction we had when we saw it. It's pretty awful. Didn't mean
so
to freak you out like
gross.
That. Adeline, I'm sorry. The actual moment where we see it, it's like me, who I think I have a higher tolerance for that stuff. And it's me actually being like, this isn't so bad. And then going, oh my God, I take it back. And then Peter's like, I guess I should probably look at that picture. And then he just screams at the top of his lungs.
Okay, happy Thanksgiving. Bon appetit.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Alex Goldman co-hosts the podcast, the brand new podcast, Reply All, a show about the internet. Alex, thank you.
Thank you.
I have lost my appetite for lunch. Julie Myers.
Why?
Yeah, I don't know why.
Why? I guess that got kind of meta there at the end, talking about the disgusting things. And we disgusted all of you. Our job here is done.
Yeah, we're almost done.
No, actually, I have 2 more minutes of job to do for you. So, on to some more ugly stuff. We talked about addiction today. We talked about how the CDC defines heavy drinking. More than 15 drinks a week for men, 8 drinks for women. Sean Riley on Facebook was flabbergasted. 8 drinks makes a woman a heavy drinker? That's a glass of wine every night with dinner and 1 extra on the weekend. That sounds like pretty normal behavior to Sean and to me. Let's just be real there. And Addie Jaffe points out that heavy drinking doesn't necessarily mean addicted. Addie used to be addicted to meth. Addicted. He's off the stuff now, but he still drinks. He can approach that heavy drinking line and know he's not addicted because he knows what real addiction looks like, which is an interesting take. Desiree called in to share her story of addiction with us. When she was a kid, she'd sip on her parents' beers and then started drinking in earnest in high school.
And as the years went on, things just got worse. I started dipping my fingers into cocaine, which eventually led to methamphetamine. And those drugs and drinking led me to really dark places, you know, to downtown LA with prostitutes and, you know, prostituting myself and all sorts of, you know, really, really horrible things that I never imagined I would be put in. You know, as of today, I have almost 2 years sober. And for me, it's a spiritual connection.
So she found her higher power when she entered a 12-step program, realized addiction was bigger than herself. 2 years sober now. Congrats, Desiree.
Congrats, Desiree. That's a happy ending to that story.
I'm sure she's thankful for that 2 years or for those 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of thankful, we are thankful for so much on this Thanksgiving. Thankful that you're listening to our show. Thankful that we have the day off tomorrow and that Evan Kleinman will be here with a 1-hour good food special in our place tomorrow at noon. So check that out. We'll be back on Friday. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. I'm Madeline Brand.